We are studying John chapter 7, and we've already begun to tap into it a little bit. It's been a few weeks, so we'll do just a little quick review here up to where we are. Last time when we were in John, we were digging into the first few verses, and we offered this literal translation of the first two verses. We talked about peripatetic teaching and teaching while you're walking around. Peripateo is a word that means to walk around. And this is the word that we find a couple of times here. After this, Jesus kept on walking around. We have an imperfect active indicative of peripatao. He kept on doing this, imperfect tense. Galilee, he kept on walking around the Galilee area. He didn't desire to walk around Judea, same thing, peripatao again, in the imperfect, because the Jews kept on seeking to kill him. Now, the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. So we talked about the feasts, and that's where we spent most of our time last time. These few verses set a pretty tense mood. And understand that Jesus is only 6 months away from the cross at this point. So things are really ramping up. The hostility against Jesus and his message is ramping up as well. So we corrected this translation to give us a sense of this mood that's prevalent as we begin John chapter 7. Second, we noted that the Jews were seeking to kill him, and the Jews there means the Jewish leaders that were antagonistic to Christ. Obviously not all Jews. I mean, all of the disciples were Jews. There's that. But it gives us this idea that there's certainly confrontation ahead, and we'll see it again in spades in this chapter. Third, the phrase after this that begins this chapter is pretty vague because the events of John chapter 6 take place 6 months before this. So after this, but sometime, half a year after this, by the time we get here. Now understand, the Feast of Booths is at hand, so, you know, we're in the fall, but the following spring is the Passover that Jesus will be crucified, okay? So just keep that in mind. We are really in the shadow of the cross here. So there's a six-month gap between the end of John chapter 6 and the GDD, that great disciple defection, and the things that we see here. Fourth, the fact is noted that the Feast of the Tabernacles is at hand, or the Jewish Sukkot. This is a festival where the Jews, even to this day, faithful Jews, believing Jews, will live outside in huts, in booths that they make. And the idea is, it's a picture of the way that the Lord provided for Israel while they were in the wilderness, and also that God was with them. You know what the word tabernacle means? It means to pitch a tent. And the tabernacle was the tent where God lived in the midst of the people while they were wandering in the desert. So the idea is when the children of Israel would look at the tabernacle, the tent, what would they think? God is with us. And indeed he was. So tabernacles is this picture of God with his people. And it's especially an eschatological or future picture of the fact that God will dwell with his people in the millennial kingdom in a very literal way. That 1,000-year kingdom of the Lord is the time when God will dwell again with his people visibly and physically. So it's a very, very exciting thing. We remember in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then in verse 14, and the Word became flesh, and the Greek word says tabernacled. I think the best translation of that phrase would be, and the Word became flesh and pitched a tent among us. That's what God did. That's what God did in Jesus. When Jesus came and lived on this earth, he pitched a tent among us. One of the translations says, it's a loose translation, but I think it gets the idea. He says, and the Word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. Now, that's a very loose translation, but I think it kind of gives us the idea. When Jesus came, God moved into town. And we beheld him, John says. We beheld his glory. It was on display for all to see. So this is happening at the time when the Jews are celebrating a festival about how someday Jesus will dwell among his people in a perfect kingdom, the millennial kingdom. And so his brothers are going to chirp in and they're going to have some opinions. Anybody have a family where everybody has an opinion? Right? Anybody have a family where everybody has an opinion and they are not shy about saying it? Yeah, well, Jesus apparently came from one of those kinds of families. You're going to feel right at home with today's message. So it's in the middle of this feast, and it's going to bring up a little bit of a problem, by the way, that we're going to try to solve a little bit. Our passage says that this feast, the Feast of Booths, was at hand. And so this sets the stage or the context for everything that will come later. So there are very strong end times connotations to this chapter. And I think they're going to really speak to the things that Jesus is going to say. Understanding the context is what I'm trying to say is understanding the context is really going to help us in this chapter. Picking and choosing verses without the context is just a disaster. That's not the way to study the Bible. We've got to know where these things sit. Okay, so verse 3, his brother said to him, now here we go. How do we know what his brothers really mean? Are they being, hey, Jesus, you are the Messiah. That is so awesome. Go show people. Or are they like, Jesus, Mr. Big Messiah, why don't you go show people? You know, we don't know. We only have the words. But I think we have some hints here that let us know what is going on. So his brother said to him, hey, leave here. You've been walking around here. Go walk around there. I mean, this is podunk country over here, right? This is like the rural villages, Capernaum. And I mean, this is around the Lake of Galilee. This is the place where it was like, you know, the backwoods. Go to Jerusalem. If you're the you want people to know who you are, if you're that guy, well, go up there. That's where all the, you know, guys in the fancy clothes that lead Israel are. I mean, show yourself to the, you know, let everybody see. Nobody has this kind of thing and wants people to know about it and does it in secret. I mean, nobody does that. Well, here's what they say. Leave here and go up to Judea that your disciples may see the works that you're doing. This is interesting, your disciples, because the last verses of the last chapter say that all of his disciples left him, most of them, right? There was a great defection. So maybe what they're saying is, listen, why don't you go back to Jerusalem, show them who you are, and maybe you'll win some of those people back, right? Strategies for ministry. If I had a nickel for every email that I get in the course of 1 week that tells me how we can make our ministry explode and how it's all Madison Avenue stuff. It's all advertising stuff. It's all marketing gimmicks. And if there's one thing that should never characterize the church, it's gimmicks. This is not about gimmicks. This is about authentic life. Jesus said to Peter, you are a small movable stone that can be easily flung across a parking lot. But I say to you, upon this rock, what I just said, what you just professed, I will build my church. Who's building the church? Jesus is. It's not the pastor's job to build the church. It's the pastor's job to feed the church. It's the pastor's job to lead the church, to go before the Lord and discern what he's saying to the church and step out of the way so that he can say it. Anyway, am I venting? No. So, for no one, his brothers say, no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. So, what do they mean by this? And then verse 5, even his brothers didn't believe in him. Ah, so there's a pair of glasses that we can put on to interpret what we just read through. His brothers are his half-brothers. They're the children of Mary and Joseph. But Jesus obviously was, his father is God and his mother was Mary. But they're his family. These are his brothers that he grew up with. And they will become believers and leaders in the church, but they're not believing yet. And we're only 6 months away from the cross. 3 years Jesus has been doing ministry and they think he's nuts. We'll see that today. Understand that Jesus has been doing this Messiah stuff for, you know, 3 years. He's been turning water into wine and all of this incredible stuff. And they say, quit walking around Galilee. Go up to Jerusalem and see if you can convince some people to follow you. So while this may make sense going up to Jerusalem, a lot of things may make sense to us that make no sense to the Lord whatsoever, because with Jesus, timing is everything. And timing means when the Father tells him to go, that's when it's time to go. So his brothers reasoned the place to settle the Messiah question, Jesus, is not here, but it's up the, down there. It's in, well, up there. It's elevated. It's higher, right? It's south, though. So it's down there and it's up there at the same time. A miracle! Well, that was inspired a little bit. I write this down. Up there and down there. Anyway, so, and you know what? So that's the place to do it, his brothers are reasoning. And you know what, Jesus? What better time? Feast of Tabernacles? It's like, oh, it's all over Messiah stuff. I mean, you're going to go up there. You're going to show them your glory during the feast that celebrates the Messianic kingdom? Perfect. And so you would think that Jesus may say, yeah, you know, guys, maybe you've got something going. But they didn't believe in Jesus, and they were saying this. So we suspect their motives here. And this brings up a principle that we looked into when we studied the Judas file, and that is proximity to Jesus, nearness to Jesus, either in a family or around his disciples, does not guarantee faith. Nobody was closer to Jesus during his earthly ministry than Judas was. And he was desperately lost. It's quite possible that they were being insincere, and I think they were, when they suggested these things. Maybe even mocking. We don't want to judge motives, but one thing is certain. They did not understand Jesus' mission and how God was going to glorify Jesus. So he was going to glorify Jesus. There's no question about it. He was going to demonstrate his glory, but it wasn't going to be by going and wowing the crowds at the Feast of Tabernacles. It was going to be at the next festival, Passover, on a cross. Selah. Verse 6, Jesus said, my time has not yet come, but your time's always here. It's always time for you to go and do whatever you feel like doing. That's not the way I work, is what he's saying. The world can't hate you. Well, why not? Well, we'll tell you in a minute. The world can't hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast. Highlight that word, this. It's going to be important. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. And after saying this, he remained in Galilee. So Jesus' answer to me sounds a little like a rebuke. It's easy for you to say that he should go to Jerusalem. His brothers could come and go as they pleased without any consequences whatsoever. But we just read that the Jews were trying to kill Jesus. And so it wasn't time for him to go up yet. They could do whatever they felt like doing. Jesus, however, was always seeking the Father's will. And that includes not only what to do, but when to do it. And by the way, this is the essence of wisdom, folks. Not only doing the right thing, the thing that pleases the Lord, but at the right time. Doing the right thing at a wrong time can be a disaster. So, as I said, the Father would publicly display Jesus and his glory, but he would do it upon the cross, and the time for the cross had not yet come. When Paul rebuked the Galatians for reverting back to the law in Galatians 3:1, he said, O foolish Galatians, who has put a spell on you, is what this means. Who's bewitched you? Are you guys, is this magic? Witchcraft? Are you guys being influenced by demons? Have you lost your mind? Oh, foolish Galatians, who bewitched you? It was before your eyes that Christ was publicly crucified, portrayed as crucified. This was not done in secret. Jesus would be glorified, just like his brothers are suggesting, but not at this feast, at the one that would come in the spring. And so timing is an important part of Jesus' ministry. As I said, the right thing done at the wrong time can be a total disaster. So Jesus says, I'm not going up to the feast, for my time is not yet fully come. And the time that he's referring to is obviously the cross. It's not time for Jesus to reveal himself that way. Jesus said to his brothers in verse 6, the B part, your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. The world posed no threats to the unbelieving brothers of Jesus because they were part of the world. Have you noticed that the conflict with the world only comes when we actually take a stance to follow Jesus? There's two kinds of people in the world. Those who belong to Jesus and those who do not. And these folks have a difficult time getting along. I don't know if you've noticed. John 7, 7a, the world cannot hate you. The world refers to the people in the world that are estranged from God. In John chapter 15, Jesus will explain this in greater detail. Verse 18 says, if the world hates you, he's talking to his disciples. That's me and you. If the world hates you, know that it hated me before you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you're not of the world, I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Interesting, right? Remember the word that I said to you, the servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. Just another reminder of the beautiful freedom we experience in this country where we can go along without any serious persecution so far. Well, also in John 17:14, Jesus is going to pray. He's going to pray on the night that he's betrayed. He's going to be on the cross at 9 o'clock the next morning. And he prays to the Father, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. You know what I love about that? All right, if I'm not of the world and I'm going to be hated because of it, at least I know that I'm like my Lord. Because he's not of the world either. So that's the side that I want to be on. Jesus tells his brothers, the world can't hate you, but it hates me because I tell them that their works are evil. You ever notice that? When you tell somebody that their works are evil, they don't like it? Yeah. Well, this is what Jesus said. He stepped into the world to point out our darkness. He was the light that exposed the darkness, and all the cockroaches started heading for the corners. He declared to even those who purported to speak for God, the Pharisees, that they were completely missing who God is and what God is like and misrepresenting the love and the mercy and compassion of the Father to the people. So Jesus said, you go up to the feast. You want to tell me I should go up to the feast? You go up to the feast. I'm not going to this feast. My time has not yet fully come. And after saying this, he remained in Galilee. All right, three quick things. I'm lying. Two quick things and one little longer thing. First off, go up is repeated twice here because literally Jerusalem is elevated. They had to go up to Jerusalem. So that's very accurate. Second, we're told by John that after saying these things, Jesus remained in Galilee and the brothers went up to the feast. And third, causes a little problem. And we mentioned it last time, but how do we solve it? Because there seems to be a contradiction here, or that Jesus is telling a lie, or maybe it's not a lie, maybe it's just a fib, or maybe it's some kind of other untruth, which makes us uncomfortable all the time. Anybody have a problem with Jesus not telling the truth? I do, and I think we all should, right? So the problem is, Jesus says, you go up to the feast, I'm not going to this feast, and then he says he stays in Galilee for a little bit, and then he goes up to the feast. Was he not telling his brothers the truth? Or he said, the reason I'm not going up to the feast is because my time has not yet come. Had his time now come? Inquiring minds want to know. What is going on over here? How do we solve this problem? Did he lie? Was he caught in a little white lie here? Did he deliberately deceive his brothers? Did he change his mind? Does he have the prerogative to change his mind? Was it now time for him to go up to the feast when it wasn't 5 seconds ago? Yes, a little bit of a problem. How do we solve this? I did so much reading on this. It's amazing, the ways these things are explained. I'm going to pare all of this down to three things that are, I think, the ones that have the most a gravity to them, okay? The first way we could resolve this is by changing the Bible. And what happens is some, like the New King James Version, adds a word, and others as well, they add a word in here, I am not yet going up to the feast. And so there are some who argue that there are some early manuscripts that have that reading, not the earliest manuscripts, but there are a few that have that reading, and that solves the problem. Jesus is saying, you go up to the feast, I'm not going up to the feast yet. It doesn't really solve the problem of, well, why not just come up now if you're going to go eventually? But there are those who argue that this is a possible reading of the Greek New Testament, even though it's not the oldest manuscripts. So this is the reading of the New King James. You go up to the feast, I'm not yet going up. Greek scholar Lenski, who is one of my real heroes, has a different solution, and I think it makes a lot of sense. He focuses on the word this. When Jesus says, I am not going up to this feast, what he means is, I'm not going up to the feast that you just described. In other words, he said, well, go up to the feast and glorify yourself. And Jesus is saying, I'm not going up to this feast. I'm not doing what you're asking me to do. That's not what I'm going to do. So he focuses on this demonstrative pronoun here, that this feast, the one you just described, I'm not going to have anything to do with that. And so when it says that he went up later, he's not contradicting himself because he's going to the feast, but he's not going to the feast that they described. Does that make sense? That's a second solution. A third one is by Dr. Klink, who is... always surprises me. I mean, just an amazing scholar. But he argues that, how do I want to put this? He argues that Jesus is actually saying, listen, I can't go up to the feast as a normal participant the way that somebody else would be a normal participant in the feast. Why? I am the tabernacle. I'm the one that they're gathering together to celebrate. So I can't just go up to the feast and, you know, expect to participate. And he's going to go up to the feast, but he's not going to participate in any meaningful way. He only gets there halfway through the feast. He has no intention of participating in all of the events of the feast. So the idea is that Jesus is the tabernacle because he's the one who will dwell with his people during the millennial kingdom. So how do we put it all together? Out of all of this reading, Gene, do you have anything salient to say about this problem? Well, no, not really. I will say this. I don't like to change the text because that sounds artificial to me. Most of the readings say, I am not going to this feast, not I'm not going yet. So I reject that reading. I don't think that that's what I think that there's more happening here than Jesus just saying, I'm not going yet. What makes the most sense to me is the idea that Jesus is rejecting their description of the feast, the one where Jesus reveals himself. I like Lenski's idea. I love Klink's idea too. But the one that, focusing on that pronoun, this feast, makes the most sense to me. That's the best that I can do with it. But it's a seeming contradiction, but I don't think it's a contradiction really. Okay, I got to move quickly here, folks. Now, the passage that we studied this morning... this portion that we studied brings up a very real problem. Maybe a problem that you have experienced from time to time too. I say that snickering to myself inside because I know we've all experienced this problem, and that is family problems. Can you believe that Jesus had family problems? That there was actually conflict in the Holy Family, right? But Jesus, this is something that we see over and over again in the Testament, in the New Testament. Jesus is about to encounter a major conflict when he gets to Jerusalem. But before he even goes to Jerusalem, he's got a conflict with his brothers. Jesus, why don't you go and do this? It's not my time to go and do this. You go and do that. Sound familiar? So, Many times, Jesus is the very source of the conflicts that we have with our family. If we're people of devout faith, we really care about our faith, and we don't compromise about our faith, it can cause problems. Although Jesus and his family could trace their roots all the way back to David, they were by no means royalty. His father, or stepfather, Joseph, was a carpenter by trade. This is not unimportant work, but it's not the work of kings. And Mary was astonished at the events that surrounded Jesus' birth. Of course, the Magi coming from far-flung places, and the presentation in the temple, and what Anna and Simeon say when Jesus is dedicated. But her interactions with Jesus as a grown man sound to me like her, like the interactions of any mother with a grown man. I hear my mother saying many of the same things that Mary would say to Jesus. In John chapter 2, the wine runs out, and they're at a wedding. We've studied this in detail, and Jesus and his mother are at the wedding, and Mary goes to Jesus with the problem, and Jesus says, John writes, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine, and Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? I didn't get the memo. I didn't get the email. Was I supposed to bring the wine? My hour has not yet come, he says. And then his mother does to him what my mother would have done to me. Completely ignored him. And goes to the servant and says, just do whatever he tells you to do. And you know what Jesus did? What his mother asked. He turned the water into wine. So, do what he tells you to do. Mary had certainly been through a lot to be the mother of our Lord Jesus. We know this. The whole trip that she had to make from Nazareth to Bethlehem was very, very difficult indeed in a very pregnant stage, right? There was no room at the inn, and so her first child was born surrounded by the sounds and smells of animal, not very feng shui. And then when Jesus was presented at the temple by Joseph and Mary, it should have been a time of unbelievable joy. You know, this is a time of joy, you know, presenting a baby. And yet, Simeon holds the baby and says, behold, this child is appointed for the fall and the rise of many in Israel and a sign to be oppressed. And then he looks at his mother and he says, and a sword will pierce through your own soul. And then as a very young child, she and Joseph had to move the child to Egypt because Jesus was in danger of being murdered by the unthinkable infanticide that Herod had decreed. And then, of course, there was the public scandal around the birth of Jesus. You know, she was betrothed to be married, but she wasn't married yet, and she's obviously very pregnant. Angels had appeared separately to both Mary and Joseph, and by faith they received that. It's incredible. And their faith was incredible. There was no hiding the pregnancy, and I find it very unlikely that anyone would have believed their explanation of the miraculous birth. I think it's probably been tried many times since. But it was true. I think Mary suffered a lot to be Jesus' mother, don't you? But as those early days wore on, I think she was more pained in the later years of Jesus, especially the years of his ministry. There's no question that Jesus' family struggled with his behavior and with his words. Everywhere Jesus went, people flooded the place. They wanted to hear what he had to say. Eventually, the Pharisees took notice of him. And what did they do? They turned against him. They were looking for reasons to kill him. In Mark chapter 3, Jesus and his newly appointed disciples entered a home, and so many people followed them that they couldn't even eat. And it was hard and troubling, I'm sure, for Mary and the rest of Jesus' family to understand this. Why this popularity? Why are they all following Jesus? And by the way, how come the Pharisees don't get it? If Jesus is the Messiah, wouldn't they be the first ones to understand this? And why are they against my boy? And she struggled with this. I know she did. So in Mark chapter 3, they decided to stage an intervention. And here's what it says, verse 20, and he went home. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat. And when the family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he's out of his mind. We have to capture Jesus like the cult, those guys that turn people away from the cults. We have to capture Jesus. We have to bring him back home, deprogram him. He's out of his mind. That's his family. I guarantee you that hurt the Lord. Right? He wasn't insensitive to these things. Imagine it. Your mom thinks you're nuts. Your brothers think you're nuts. And then there's Luke chapter 8. You want to talk about like a little bit of tension? Okay. His mothers and his brothers came to him. Jesus is speaking. His mothers and his brothers came to him. My mother and brother comes to me. I'm like, whatever I'm doing, I stop what I'm doing and I'm overjoyed. His mother and brothers came to him, but they could not reach him because of the crowd. And then he was told, Jesus was told, your mother and your brothers are standing outside. They want to talk to you. They're desiring to see you. But Jesus answered, my mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it. Ow. That stings. So Jesus' relationship with his family was, well, complicated. Much as our relationships with our family many times are complicated. So how do we navigate through, as believers, conflict with the family? And in the last 90 minutes of the message, I just want to go over a couple of points that I think might help us. This is from Mary Yerkes, who wrote an article for Focus on the Family called Family Ties When Conflict Strikes Close to Home. Here's what she writes. Families matter to God. That's why few things are more painful than unresolved family conflict. Domineering in-laws, wayward teens, jealous stepchildren can hurt a happy home and turn it into a war zone. She goes on to say, some issues present a great challenge. The son who disowns his Christian upbringing to pursue a homosexual relationship. The mother whose abuse and manipulation threatens to destroy a woman's marriage and her health even. A father with mental illness who abuses his children. These situations are real. Sadly, they occur within Christian families. And while some situations are resolved over time, others can last months and even years. This is interesting, right? There's no question that the closeness of family relationships makes managing these conflicts even more difficult. So as we close this morning, let me just suggest a couple of points. If we have problems with people in our family, a couple of things to keep in mind as we're navigating through. Because remember, we always want to be the Lord's man. We always want to be the Lord's woman in the situation. We don't want to compromise, but we want to be loving, understanding, especially if we have unbelieving people in our family. We can't expect lost people to act like saved people, you know. So we have to have some sympathy for that. So just a couple of things I want to point out about family conflicts, and then we'll close for this morning. First, never forget that Jesus warned us that if we're going to follow him, we will have problems in our family because of it. If we follow Jesus the way he wants to be followed, if we become disciples of the Lord, it's going to cause problems. This is what he said in Matthew chapter 10. This is not the Jesus that most people think about when the image of Jesus comes to their mind, but our Lord said, don't think that I've come to bring peace on earth. I haven't come to bring peace, but a sword, for I came to set a man against his father. And a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Not that that's what the Lord desires, but that's what it means when we take a stand for Jesus. It's going to bring conflict. They're going to think that we're crazy, we're too sold out, we're throwing away our money, or we're throwing away our time, or we're doing this or that or the other thing. But understand that even though conflict is promised, Jesus never will take second place to anything in our life, even our family. He must be number one. That's the first commandment. I'm the Lord your God. You will have no other God besides me. So that's the second point, that Jesus insists that he takes precedence over our family. He goes on to say in Matthew 10:37, whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. These are hard words, right? Because, I mean, I love my parents. I love my children. These are hard things. But Jesus says, I get it, but I've got to be first. Third, family relationships, especially those of mothers and fathers, must be honored among people, God's people. I'm going to explain what this means. Exodus 20 and verse 12 famously says, honor your mother and father, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving to you. Now, when I was younger, I always understood I had to honor my father so that my life would be long, like even one more day longer. But this is one of the big Ten Commandments. And then there's the New Testament. In the New Testament, Paul says in Ephesians 6, beginning in verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. He quotes the commandment, and he said, this is the first commandment with a promise that it may go well with you and you may live long in the land. So fathers are instructed to raise their children in a disciplined instruction of the Lord, but also to do so without provoking anger within their children. You know, we're not the commandant of a concentration camp, dads. You know, we should be loving examples of the father, but at the same time, imposing discipline that is necessary for our children to grow up into the men and women that God wants them to be. Now, let's put some of these things in perspective, though, because you may be sitting here and you may say, you know, I'm 50 years old. My mother is still here, and she gives me a really difficult time, and she tells me to do certain things, and she fights with me if I don't do it, or something like this. How do we navigate these words as believers? Well, first of all, to honor means to give weight or gravity to something. You honor it. You think about it. You consider it. You're giving it value. You're giving it weight. You're giving it gravity. It also means, to honor also means that the primary needs of our parents are being met. So if our family is without food, So, you know, if our parents are without food or something like this, honoring them, a part of honoring them is to make sure that they have what they need. Okay. By the way, that's the context of when Paul says in 1 Timothy 5:8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially members of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever, right? So, obey. Now, but honoring your mother and father, does that mean obeying your mother when you are a 50-year-old person? In our early years, the relationship that we have with parents is dictatorial. They say, do that, and we do that. But as we get older in a healthy relationship, our relationship with our parents should morph into something very healthy, a mentor-mentee type relationship, where we respect the fact that they've grown and they've matured, our children have grown and matured, but at the same time, we're there to impart the wisdom that we've learned from the scriptures and from our years, and we're available to them, but it's a different kind of relationship. When that relationship doesn't change with age, it becomes an abusive type of relationship, and big problems result. So what I'm trying to say is the relationship between a girl and her mother when the girl is 10 is not the same as the relationship with a girl and her mother when the girl is 46. There's a different kind of relationship, but yet it needs to be honored. So what does it mean? It means that when my mother would tell me something, my mother did everything she could do to keep me from going to the mission field. Everything. Because she knew I had to get into a plane, and her fear was irrational. And, you know, Gene, I would get these calls. You know, Gene, it's okay for you and Mary to get on the plane and to get on the plane and to go to over there to Greece, but you're going to endanger the life of your children by putting them in a plane? And I used to have to say, Mom, if God's will is for me to die by plane, then if I don't get on the plane, one will land on me. You know, we're not going to stop the will of God. So I didn't obey my mother when she told me not to go on the mission field. But you know what I did? I listened to her. I respected her. I said, Mom, listen, this is God's call upon our life. This is where God is leading us. But it doesn't mean that you don't devalue what she's saying. But at the same time, you have to, as an adult, go before the Lord and say, Lord, how are you leading me and my family? Taking your mom's words into consideration. Does that make sense? So honoring your mother at 46 doesn't mean obeying everything your mother wants you to do. It means listening, giving gravity and weight to what she's saying, but at the same time, going before the Lord. I'm almost done here. Fourth principle, it's always important to establish godly boundaries. Most of the problems that happen within families are when boundaries are exceeded. A mom still thinks that, she thinks that she's the mother of her grandchildren, right? And you're raising your children up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And yet, maybe you have an unbelieving mother. And so there are boundaries there. And she knows your desire that, you know, she knows what your wishes are. But yet when the kids maybe go over to her house, your wishes and your desires are not respected. Well, that's crossing boundaries. And when you, if you don't establish strong boundaries, there are going to be absolutely inevitable conflicts. Yerkes writes, appropriate boundaries are biblical because they enable you to set limits while still loving that other person. The point is that setting boundaries is not a harsh thing. It's actually a loving thing. He says, Mom, I want this relationship to flourish, but you've got to understand my position as their mom, and I've got to understand your position as their grandma. We've got to have some boundary issues here. Fifth, when a conflict arises, always affirm the relationship. What does this look like? Mom, I love you. You're my mom. But that's not something that I can do and feel like I'm following the Lord. See, what are you doing? You're saying, I can't do that. But you're also saying, you're my mom and I love you. You're affirming the relationship. Johnny, I love you. You're my son. But I can't let you live in this house if you're going to continue to destroy your body with drugs. I can't do it. I can't be a party to that. I love you. You're my son. You see, you're affirming the relationship and just reminding that this is coming out of a place of love. Sixth, we have to resolve family conflicts with Christian virtues like love and kindness and especially forgiveness intact. Paul is getting at this in Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 19. Behold, never avenge yourselves, beloved, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy, and the people in your family are not your enemy, I don't think we should see them that way. If they're lost, we should see them as lost people, misguided, people who violate boundaries. But anyway, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. Do exactly the counterintuitive thing. The thing that they would never expect, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in doing so, you heap burning coals upon a head. This is conviction. My goodness, I'm treating him so terribly, and look at how good he's treating me. This sounds like what the Lord does for us, right? He gives us mercy and mercy and mercy. And then there's Ephesians chapter 4, verse 32. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ has forgiven you. We must always allow love to do what anger and resentment can never do. Let love have a chance. Let love have a chance. That's what this idea is about. You know, your enemy is hungry, feed him. Oh, I'm glad he's hungry. Hope he starves to death. I mean, I hate that guy. Jesus said, you have to love your enemies. He said, it's easy to love people who love you. What good is that? But if you're a believer, you have to love even your enemies. And seventh and finally, we love the number sevens here. You had two sets of sevens today. 14 amazing principles. Incredible. Next time, I'm going to try to do 21. We're going to keep going until we completely lose the congregation. All right, here we go. Number seven. When we've done everything that we can do, when we've tried to bring reconciliation, when we've practiced forgiveness, when we've tried to be gracious, and nothing has worked because the other person refuses to reconcile, we have to be okay with that and we have to give it to the Lord. So we have to forgive. It's not optional for us not to forgive, but that doesn't mean the other person is going to forgive what they feel as some kind of hurt received from you. So what Paul is going to tell us is if you have a relationship with someone in your family or even someone at work or, you know, anything, if you have a relationship with someone and you can't reconcile, the reconciliation fails, there's only one thing you have to make sure of, that it wasn't because of you. You cannot, it is not optional for the reconciliation to fail because you chose not to forgive. That is not an option ever, not even one single time for a believer. We are to forgive even as we have been forgiven. It's the hardest of the Christian virtues, but it is one of the Christian virtues that the Lord expects to find in his children nonetheless. Now I want you to notice Romans chapter 12 and verse 18. Just a couple of quick things and we're all done. Last page here, folks. First of all, look at what he says. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Now notice the second word, if possible. And the reason that Paul says this is because it may not be. But don't let it be because of you. See, this is the principle. Don't let it be because of you. If possible, live at peace with all men. If the person in your family that you're having conflict with is willing to reconcile with you, then it's possible. And that reconciliation should take place because the believer should never be the one that stops the reconciliation from happening. But the second thing I want to point out about this verse is, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live at peace with all. So it's on you to do everything that you can, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be successful. And when it's not, friends, we just have to say, Lord, you know my heart. I've done everything that I can do. I've sought reconciliation. I've forgiven this person. I've tried to set godly boundaries. I've reaffirmed over and over again our relationship. Dad, I love you. I really do. You are my father. I respect you. But I have to follow the leading of the Lord in this situation. But it hasn't worked. And Lord, I give it to you. Please change the heart of the other person. Now, here's the last thing I'm going to say. We can only change our heart. We can never change someone else's. And there are times, folks, where sad as it is, hurtful as it is, we've got to be okay with that. I find this very instructive that the Lord Jesus had to deal with family conflict. And as we see Jesus moving into Jerusalem now and at the Feast of Tabernacles, we're going to see some really interesting things. But it comes in the context of living among a family that at this point think he's nuts. It's really interesting.